welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the programme that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. I'm delighted to have with me today in the studio on University Matters, Professor Peter Vassallo. He, of course, needs a little introduction to our listeners, but I shall do what I normally do and just say a few words about my guest. He's Professor of English Literature, he's head of department here from 98 to 2006. He read English Honours at the University of Malta, where he was awarded the British Council Prize for English Studies. He continued his studies as a Commonwealth Scholar and Fellow at the University of Oxford, where he obtained the degrees of MA and DPhil. Professor Vassallo has also been elected to as Fellow of the English Association. His publications include Byron, The Italian Literary Influence, and Byron and the Mediterranean, which he edited. He is a member of the Board of Directors of the International Byron Society and sits on the Advisory Editorial Board of La Questione Romantica, Bologna and Romanticism, a journal of Edinburgh. Professor Vassallo is founding editor of the Journal of Anglo-Italian Studies and is currently chair of the Institute of Anglo-Italian Studies, which promotes advanced research in this interdisciplinary field of study. He has published articles on the major Romantic poets and has written a section on Romantic narrative verse in Romanticism, an Oxford Guide, edited by Nicholas Rowe of Oxford University Press. He has been visiting professor at some of the leading British and Italian universities and has been invited as a keynote speaker at major conferences. He's currently president of the International Association of University Professors of English. He's recently completed a study of Yeats' poetry for the forthcoming The New Cambridge History of English Poetry, edited by Michael O'Neill. And his latest book is entitled British Writers and the Experience of Italy, 1800 to 1940. And it is about this publication that we shall be mainly speaking today. A warm welcome, Professor Vassallo.
Thank you, Patricia.
Obviously, we could sit here chatting for a couple of hours, I suspect.
I suppose so.
The subject of your new book. However, before we start to talk about it, a very brief word about the Institute of Anglo-Italian Studies, because it's a small but significant institute.
Yes. Well, we have to go back about 20 years and more. In the time of Father Alphonse, you may remember, he was professor of Italian, head of department, and we both were working more or less on similar lines. I was doing the Romantic period and the Romantics of Italy, especially Byron at the time, and he was working on a kind of bibliography of Anglo-Italian literary studies, which he died before completing, but which we completed for him eventually. And we got together and we said, this needs a kind of special research initiative. And at the time, there was Father Peter, who was a luminary at the university, as we all know. Unfortunately, he died recently. And he said, yes, it's a good idea, and he believed very much in interdisciplinarity. So the English department and the Italian department were working on something of common interest, which is academic. And, of course, this was ideal because it enabled me to sort of continue my research in this very rich field. And as you probably know, it's extremely difficult at the moment, and it was always difficult, for scholars to say something new about the canonical writers. Can you say something new about Byron? As my supervisor at Oxford asked me, when he was sort of more or less seeing whether he made the right choices in taking me on. I was about to do a DPhil then. And he asked me, Mr. Vassallo, Can you really? Byron's a major figure. So much has been written about him. Can you really? And I said, yes, I think I can, because I've been reading a lot about this. And it has been said that Byron was in Italy. Yes, we know that. And that the influence on his work was almost negligible by a leading scholar at the time. And I said, I think it wasn't, and I hope to prove that. And he said, oh, watch out now, you're moving into the lion's den. Mm. And he said, it's jokingly, of course. And so I just started on that. When I explained, he said, yes, it's a good idea. And yes, there is some material you can work on. And then, of course, you know what happens. You leave your supervisor and it becomes the loneliness of the long-distance researcher.
This institute has had many conferences and now has proceedings that run into, I think, 11 volumes.
11 volumes, yes. Which,
it's quite an achievement.
It is, I think. And yes, I've been helped first by Patricia Alou-Mikhalev, who has helped me very much in a cheerful way with the proofreading and with checking on the bibliography. She's very, very meticulous. And also by Gloria Lowry-Lucenta, who has now become the new director, and while I remain as chairperson and as advisory editor. And we've had a very good working relationship, which is, I think, what it should be at university.
Let's turn to your new publication. Perhaps I can make an initial comment. My sort of initial reaction when I picked it up was how impressed I was that in what is a slim volume, there is an enormous range of writers. Yeah. There were writers that wouldn't immediately come to mind as mm-hmm. having Anglo-Italian connections. There are some very obvious ones, but there are others which are not, with this lovely sort of filo conduttore of the influence of Italy.
Yeah. The range is, I would say, for Madame de Stael. She was an extraordinary woman, Swiss, really, brought up in Switzerland, but then in Paris. Her father was extremely rich. She was the financial advisor to Louis XIV. And she married a rich nobleman, the Comte de Stael. So, and she was an intellectual. And she, a brilliant woman, really, incurred the anger of Napoleon eventually, who didn't banished her from Paris, and she went to live in Coppet on Lake Geneva. She had a beautiful villa where she entertained all the intellectuals. She went to Italy with some friends of hers, the Schlegel brothers, and toured Italy, fell in love with Italy, the landscape, the Italians. Felt sorry for them because they were oppressed at the time. They were under Austrian rule, as you know, and was hoping somehow that she would resuscitate their glory by creating a character, Corinne, who's very much like herself, who falls in love with a Scottish nobleman, and she shows him round and shows all the beauties of Italy, the Italian monuments, architecture, literature. So you have, in a sense, a love story, which is also a part travelogue and part cultural sort of display of Italy. And that starts. And then Byron admired Madame de Stael. Byron didn't really like intelligent women, I have to say.
Competition.
Well, possibly. And also he felt that they interfered too much with his lovemaking, I meant. But this is something on the side. But he admired her, and he said she's a brilliant woman who wrote quartos and spoke volumes. but he was very friendly with her when she went to England. In fact, he gave a copy of Corinne, her book, which was written in French at the time, before it was translated, to Teresa Guiccioli, who was his mistress in Venice, as you probably know.
One of the things that also struck me was the influence of Dante, which seems, again, to be another filo conductor that runs through all these various
yes.
writers that you
yes.
mention in the book. Yes. And it's quite amazing to realize that the translation to blank verse only came about, obviously from Italian to English, in the early 1800s. But yeah. It was providential.
It was providential because very few writers read Italian. You know, there was an Italian fashion in England which goes back to the Elizabethan court, Elizabeth I. And it was providential. And then they realized Carey's great translation, Henry Carey's of Dante. Even Keats read Carey's translation, because he couldn't read Italian, and many others like him. And so they have that, it opened up this great work, which is really about man, and as Dante puts it, come l'uomo s'eterno, as how man becomes eternal in his relationship with God, and good and evil, and justice and injustice. And so he creates this vision of a marvelous vision of the Inferno, the Purgatorio, and the Paradiso. And of course, Dante is also contemporary in the sense that it's not something remote. He puts some people he knew, Florentines he knew, into hell. Even his old teacher, Brunetto Latini, is there. And he's surprised to see him there. And he says, you know, said Brunetto, are you here? He said, one imagines, a reader would imagine that the answer Brunetto would have given him, or should have given him, is, well, you put me here, didn't you?
But it
goes all the way up to Byron, who thought of him as a much maligned patriot who's exiled. Shelley, who thought of him as one of the greatest minds. Well, talking about the filo conduttore, he was the filo conduttore of all Europe, he said, in his great essay on the defense of poesy. And then going all the way up to T.S. Eliot, I mentioned T.S. Eliot, and Yeats, who also mentioned. Yeats was fascinated by Dante, too.
Was the influence a cultural influence in the sense that they recognized in Dante's efforts something that fitted their own romantic approach to their own poetry? Was there anything also with regard to technique that they took from him?
Well, they realized that Dante was writing in a very difficult visa, which is the Terza Rima, which was very difficult to do. Shelley tried it. He translated parts of the last cantos of the Purgatorio into English. Very good translation. Byron himself translated the Francesca da Rimini episode. He called it Fanny of Rimini, and jokingly. He's always joking and always tongue-in-cheek. But it's a good translation, and they consider Dante as, well, Byron is a poet of strong emotions and strong patriotic feeling. Shelley as interested in the transcendental, in the spirit, the spiritual inside man, which emerges either with the west wind or with some beautiful landscape in Italy, as he says, the west wind being the Libeccio. And Shelley's always very sensitive to nature, the natural scene. And that sets him off thinking philosophically, you know, the splendors of the firmament and the universe die not. He's consoling himself at the loss of Keats and Adonais. That's very Dantean, isn't it? And then, say Yeats takes it as Dante who created poetry out of the inner torment within himself. Out of the grosser material of the earth creates beautiful poetry. And he translated that into luxuriant song, says Yeats, and into one of the most beautiful women admired by men. Beatrice, who is human, beautiful, a beautiful woman that Dante knew, but she's also spiritual in the sense that she is a model for spirituality.
The attraction of Italy, the country itself, this the English saw it as elegant decadence. Was it because Italy sort of like Janus looked backwards towards classical culture and forwards towards Renaissance humanism and also to the church with all its contradictions? What really was it that attracted Well, English so much.
Yeah, you're now dealing with the great minds, obviously, of English literature. Byron Shelley, George Eliot, who's interested in Florence, and many others, and Lawrence even. And they all approach Italy in a different way. They appropriate it sometimes, the fatal beauty of Italy, the marvellous landscape, beautiful climate, oppressed people who need some encouragement to shake off the shackles of oppression. And Byron takes that attitude. It's a double attitude. One is, Canto 4, Childe Harold says, "Oh Venice, you are the empress of the sea. Now thou art, a humble woman begging, more or less." And so he goes back historically and says, "Look, this is what has been allowed to happen." So it's political too. But then Venice also becomes a way where he's making a contrast between Venetian life with its joie de vivre, with its exuberance, with its carnivalesque spirit. Venice, he writes, is in the estro of a carnival, and therefore I must join. And of course, he needed no stimulus for that. And he uses that as a contrast between the Venetian way of life. Here people do things, they are amoral, and the cold moral north, which sets rules of propriety and decorum all over the place. And if you don't conform, then you're an outcast, as he claimed to be. And it's about that. It's about, a husband who goes away, a wife who takes a lover. After 10 years, he comes back, dressed as a Turk. He doesn't recognize him. Eventually, he proves that I'm your husband. And they somehow live happily ever after, the ménage à trois, which he said was a real story told to him by somebody he knew. Oh. So Byron was always saying, I never invent things. I always base them on fact.
It seems to be the dichotomy of Italy seems to be the attraction in itself, the fact that the British couldn't resist the beauty.
Yes, this dichotomy really is in Madame de Staël, because you see you've got the English nobleman looking along and says, the children are filthy, aren't they, in Naples, but they're having a good time, they're living. They're not straight-jacketed. And the contrast is between, for example, in a scene in Naples, there's an English ship, and English people there are all very properly dressed, uniformed people going out, and it's a Sunday service. And then, in contrast, in the Naples Bay, people are enjoying themselves, laughing and singing. And if you just contrast this, and then you expect it to, of course, say to yourself, they're living, and the others are living by rules.
What about someone like Lucy Honeychurch? I mean, this is a figure that listeners will be familiar with. She is a little bit different to Corinne. She ends up in a different way.
Yes, and this is, of course, written almost a century afterwards. This is a room of the view. Well, she's travelling. She's in Florence, and she has with her her guidebook, which is the great Ruskin. And what Ruskin says about Florence, and Ruskin's sort of mornings in Florence, so she's following the guidebook very studiously. And then suddenly she decides to, when she goes to Santa Croce, she decides to give that up. She wants to see it, not as somebody else sees it, where he is very dogmatic. Ruskin was the great sage, wasn't he? He was the man who wrote about modern painters, about the stones of Venice, about Italy and what it had to offer. He goes back to Gothic Italy. He doesn't like the Renaissance very much because there's a Puritan streak. Because the Renaissance, as you were saying, the Renaissance, of course, broke free from the constraints of Holy Mother Church, which at the time was and still is made up of male figures, let's put it that way, dominant male figure, autocratic in a sense, and the Renaissance broke free. So of course you had people like Vico and Giordano Bruno, who were pronounced to be heretical, and of course they but of course the Renaissance spread right all the way. was the light that lit up all Europe, as you know, and it comes from Italy, the Italian states.
Lucy herself, she did break free, as you're saying. She decides to abandon Ruskin.
Yes.
And to follow her heart.
And she sees it, yes, for the first time. And she doesn't go to the places that Ruskin recommends, but to the Innocenti, which is the sort of orfanatrofio at the time, the little babes. And she looks at them and she says, and they are, it's a Renaissance. Not a Gothic place. So already she's moving away from the tutorship, the remote tutorship of Ruskin. She's seeing things for herself. Of course, Forster was writing with a purpose. He was saying, "Let us not go by, let us not live life by the guidebooks written to us by other people, the moral guidebooks." And he himself was writing also with another purpose, which was to, as a homosexual, at the time, of course, homosexuality was considered to be rather
abominable. Frowned upon, to say the least.
Yes, exactly. And he was sort of saying, look, I mean, these are people who are finding themselves. And in a country like England, that is not allowed because there are so many rules and travel guides, moral travel guides, that you can't get lost somewhere.
She ends up with the man she loved. Mm-hmm. But you're not quite sure at the end of the day, though, whether she's happy.
Yes, but I think they go to Florence for the honeymoon then.
Yes, yes.
So it seems to suggest that.
Yes, uh-huh.
That they want to go to Florence, because Florence plays a very important part as in many ways. It was a beautiful place. But it also was the cradle of the Renaissance, which comes out in Yeats, for example.
You mentioned Byron's contribution, of course. There's this lovely phrase which I picked up from your book, where Byron's Ravenna journal, when he was in Ravenna, he says, "Only think, a free Italy, why it is the very poetry of politics." So your hero saw Dante as a political hero, as you said. He was moved by the Austrian domination of this amazing country, as he saw it, and he saw Italy sort of like personified as a woman. So this the politics of Italy has been also a catalyst to not only Byron's poetry, but others' poetry as well.
Well, he was writing that in Ravenna, and they had gone to Ravenna with the Wiccioli family. Teresa Wiccioli was actually the daughter of Count Gambo. And they were anti-Austrian, as it were, Austrian family, quite patriotic. And she, Therese, which we had persuaded him to, as it were, try to write something in favour of Italy, the new Italy. And that, he wrote the prophecy of Dante there, where Dante is sort of prophesying that one day Italy will be free. And that all the harms done to her somehow will disappear, and he was actually engaged with the Carbonari, who were a secret society, who were resisting Austrian rule. They were not really organized, but they were, and they had a song which Venetian Romagnola. Went sort of sem tutti per la libertà, and Byron could sing it, so he was very involved in that, and he was enrolled for a short while in the American Carbonari, which was also another group, and he had his own code word, which he says, but I cannot repeat that, so put asterisks on his journal, because to keep the secrecy of his password, as it were.
I was surprised in my ignorance to find W.B. Yeats such an important figure as far as this continuing influence of Italy is concerned.
Yes, well, that is both aesthetic and political. Aesthetic, because Yeats felt that the beauty of Italy came out of the Renaissance and the beautiful ducal states, Mantua, Ferrara, Florence, and so on, Este. And they gave rise to the culture of beauty, which he admired, as you know. He was always writing about these beautiful women, Mort Gon, for example, a goddess or whatever, immortalizing these, Mort Gon in particular. And apart from that, he was thinking in terms of an Irish Renaissance, that Ireland should create its own sources, not just rely on English sources. And Italy was a way of doing it. And he wanted to do for Dublin what the Italians had done in the ducal city states. They patronized the arts. And he was trying to persuade Lady Gregory, who was a wonderful woman he admired, very rich, and she has a beautiful mansion, Gould Park, where he used to go to patronize the arts. And she did, in fact. So there's a sense of creating, it is a kind of pipe dream, really, because nothing really materialized. But the source, which is Italy, and the Italian Renaissance and Italian notions of aesthetics and politics, come into his work, into his finest work. And they're there, for example, in the ancestral houses that he talks about. He admired Castiglione's notion of spezzatura, the nonchalance with which the aristocrat sort of performed a number of things all equally well, poetry, dancing, music, and so on, horse riding. And that was the ideal, as he says about Lady Gregory's son who died, Major Gregory. He was our Philip Sidney, scholar, soldier, horseman, all mankind's epitome. Okay. And that was his great ideal. And he felt that this could be done. And therefore, Ireland would stop being a nation, as he put it, of penny pinchers and penny savers, adding the halfpence to the pence, but they would go beyond that into realizing a sense of their own patriotism and a culture that they seem to have gone by.
Well, I knew it was going to be difficult to keep this to our usual 26 minutes. I'd like to thank Professor Peter Vassallo very, very much for coming to the studio today to talk about his new book, British Writers and the Experience of Italy, 1800 to 1940. Thank you so much.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.